Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Ram Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Zeina Arafat, author of You Exist Too Much, published by Catapult in 2020.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a pretty cozy idea. Today, we're drinking an On the Ledge, inspired by Zeina's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
For those not familiar with Zeina's work, Zeina Arafat is a Palestinian-American writer. Her debut novel, You Exist Too Much, has been praised by O, the Oprah Magazine, Vogue, Elle, Harper's Bazaar, Good Morning America, NPR, and BBC Radio. It was selected by Roxane Gay as her favorite book of 2020. Zeina's stories and essays have appeared in publications including The New York Times, Granta, The Believer, Virginia Quarterly Review, Vice, BuzzFeed, Guernica, and The Atlantic, as well as others. O Magazine says of Arafat's You Exist Too Much that the book is a, quote, provocative and seductive debut, end quote, of desire and doubleness that follows the life of a young Palestinian-American woman caught between cultural, religious, and sexual identities as she endeavors to lead an authentic life.
You Exist Too Much is the story of a Palestinian-American woman that is told in vignette shifting between youth and adulthood and the U.S. and Middle East, including New York, Jordan, Lebanon, and Palestine. Arafat's protagonist struggles to exist in large part because when she told her mother that she was queer, her mother's response was, "You exist too much." Her emotions manifest in an eating disorder, reckless romantic encounters, and unhealthy obsessions with unavailable people. She goes to a treatment center called The Ledge, where she works on her love addiction. It is here that she begins to understand her internal traumas and how they've shaped her. You Exist Too Much is a story that explores the desires and struggles of a woman to understand her cultural, religious, and sexual identity. We're really looking forward to talking today with Zeina about her debut novel.
Yeah, how are you feeling today, Zeina?
I'm good. It's a cloudy, rainy day in Brooklyn, so it's nice to be kind of cozied up here on the podcast with you guys.
Yay! Awesome. Well, today we are looking forward to talking about your work and also hearing from you giving us a little reading later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
Yeah, I do. I really enjoy giving live readings. It's actually one of the most fun aspects of putting a book into the world. So yeah.
That's great. Now, have you done any Zoom readings or anything like that over the past year?
I've done so many. Yeah, it's been the year of Zoom readings, and I'm based in Brooklyn, so I've gotten to read at a number of venues and bookstores and reading series around here. So I certainly prefer live readings just because it's great to be able to connect with readers face to face. But what's so great about Zoom readings is that you can have people come in from all over the world. Geography is not a non-issue. So there are benefits to both.
Yeah, I can see that. As this is a debut novel and you're now working on a book of essays, can you tell us how this book fits in with your future author trajectory?
Yeah, so this novel explores the life of a Palestinian-American woman who grows up between cultures, between continents, who is grappling with in-betweenness in various forms, culturally in terms of her sexuality as a bisexual woman, who is kind of part of the trajectory of the book is from going from a place of feeling like she cannot exist in her own skin comfortably to hopefully arriving at a place of self-acceptance and self sort of validation. And my essay collection also explores characters who are in between cultures as well, who sort of exist on the outskirts of feel as though they're not fully one thing or the other, and who are sort of struggling to adapt to new homelands, to occupying unacceptable spaces in terms of sexuality, in terms of religion, in terms of gender identity. So there is like a correspondence between the narrator and the people in the essays that I am writing about and the challenges that those people face.
It's really interesting. I like the idea of in-betweenness.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a big theme of my life and of my work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really interested in that kind of double consciousness that you see discussed in a lot of different literary work where people are juggling identities. I'm also interested in how you often have kind of a sexual element to literary fiction that's more so than some literary fiction in the past. In particular, I really liked your depiction of a female character who kind of owns her sexuality and sometimes sexuality dysfunctionality in this book. What responses did you get from other writers? I'm just curious, critiquing it as you wrote it. Did you feel like a wave of support, or were there mixed reactions to what you wanted to bring to the page?
I mean, there were mixed reactions. Some people were really sort of supportive, of course, of the depiction of a woman who was embodying her sort of sexuality in a way that maybe a man would traditionally, right? Where she was sort of engaging in sexual acts and just like even just sort of sexual fantasies without restraint, I should say. And then other people found it kind of uncomfortable, right? And of course, it is. To an extent, I mean, there's a sort of pathology behind a lot of her behavior that I'm trying to get at. And so I'm aware as the writer that a lot of her actions are less than savory. And that,
and well, that's an interesting way to put it.
And that she is behaving in ways that can be self-destructive. But what I was really interested in was both A, creating a character who was unrestrained when it came to sexuality in the same way that a male character traditionally could be, but also in exploring why she engaged in self-destructive behavior at times. I was really interested in the sort of why behind the what, even though that could be really painful to witness at times for the reader and for readers that I, shared the novel with as I was working on it.
Oh yeah. How many bisexual narrators do you see in literary novels right now?
Right. Not that many. That was the other thing. I was really determined to create a bisexual character and to explore how her cultural heritage, how her family background, how her religious background, all of that factored into her behavior and just her sexuality and how it manifested.
Yeah, she's a really intriguing character. And as a reader, I had a lot of feelings like some of the ones that you were talking about, ranging from frustrated to sympathetic to empathetic. And I was wondering about your decision to leave her nameless.
The title of the novel is You Exist Too Much. And it's a line spoken to the narrator by her mother. And when you tell someone you exist too much, you're essentially saying to them you should exist less. So her not having a name was a way to have her take up less space on the page, because that is something that she feels she needs to do, is take up less space in the world, because she feels like she can't exist in her own right, that she feels a lot of shame for who she is, partly stemming from just her mother's treatment of her, but also from a sense of internalized homophobia. So that's why she has no name. And she also sort of defines herself throughout the novel, like in relation to other people, like she's her mother's daughter, she is so-and-so's lover, right? And so part of her journey is not only going from a place of feeling like she should be ashamed to exist as she does, to arriving at a place where she feels proud to exist as she does, or at least accepts who she is, but also a place of not looking outwards for approval as a way to define herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the idea or the concept that you're bringing up here of a self erasure, or of like an authorial erasure of identity via the no name piece. But also connected to that for me is the idea of the fixations the narrator has on these fantasy love interests, sort of, meaning unavailable people with whom she develops intense romantic fixations. Do you think her desire to be vulnerable with love only when the beloved isn't privy to her more vulnerable revelations loops back here to her own experience with her mom's unavailability and all of that stuff? There's such an intense amount of women's narrative going on here. So please just speak to that.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, like the relationship with her mother is the central relationship of the novel, and around it sort of orbit these other relationships with these unattainable women. And they're very asymmetrical at times, these relationships. It's almost as if she's doesn't exist within them. She's not allowing herself to be vulnerable. I mean, part of setting one's sights on the unattainable is a desire to avoid vulnerability and to avoid being seen. So certainly what she's learned is that being vulnerable is dangerous. And she's learned that through her relationship with her mother. And so indeed, she selects relationships or asymmetrical sort of obsessions almost that preclude vulnerability.
Right. I want to talk more about the mother, but before we get to that, I also wanted to ask you about the structure of the book. specifically your use of flashbacks. And I was curious about how you went about organizing the plot of the book as you were in the drafting stage.
So one thing I was really interested in exploring was how seemingly insignificant moments from the past bear on our present day selves and how much of an impact they have without us even realizing it. And so that's sort of, I didn't know where I was going structurally. I wrote the book in like several bursts. I wrote like the sort of central section in the treatment center in one burst. I wrote certain romantic relationships and their own as like their own sort of narratives, and then weaving it all together to try and show how are all these things corresponding with one another, how are all of these things speaking to who she is as a person and relevant to her destructive patterns and just present day self in general. And so what I then eventually did was print out the whole novel and like tape the pages to the wall, include like vignettes that come from her childhood, her time in the Middle East, her time in the West Bank and Jordan and Lebanon. And I tried to see how within the present day trajectory, I could show how these little vignettes from the past were relevant to that present day, to each present day moment. And so they ended up being like woven in between present day text, where I would try and transition into that vignette seamlessly and assuming the reader could follow me along and understand, I'm giving enough clues and context for the reader to understand how and why this vignette from the past is happening where it is, or why this relationship narrative is interrupting this moment in the treatment center now, and how it's speaking to what's happening in the present. And I didn't want to like overly guide the transitions because I thought part of the fun for the reader is piecing the puzzle together. And so, yeah. And so it was just really, I taped all the pages to the wall and sort of moved them around to see which moments spoke to which other moments, which past moments spoke to which present moments and what have you.
I love that. I like the visual of it. And I'm also really interested that you were using these small moments, because I think when people write flashbacks or memories, they take like these really big moments that are going to have so much impact to show the present and why a character is acting the way they are. And they overlook those small moments that can be just so much more meaningful.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was what I found so interesting, was how these little moments like really have such significance.
Yeah. And you're there for just a few lines sometimes, or just a few paragraphs, and then you move on and you're like, wait, and you need to go back and look at it because it was huge. It seemed like it was small, but it was so much more.
Right. Absolutely.
And it was so vivid. I really want to hear about how culture shaped the narrative for you. I mean, I hear you talking about how this book came together in vignettes, but I also want to hear about how culture shaped the narrative for you. How did you decide, for example, how much of the book should feel Americanized and how much would address the Palestinian and international politics and conflicts?
True. I think it was sort of, wasn't always a conscious decision, you know, of how much each culture would impact, play into the novel and impact her life. But I think it started to fall together as I was myself kind of piecing the puzzle together and proportionally thinking about how much time she spent in each place and how much weight each place has for her. I think in line with her attraction to the unattainable, in many ways, the Middle East is unattainable to her because it's, you know, she's a first generation American. Her parents are immigrants. And she's very much eager to attain that cultural heritage. As much time as she spends there, she always feels as though she's not fully a part of that culture, that she's wanting to belong to it, but can't fully belong to it. More so, I think, than American culture for her, because also Middle Eastern culture is the culture that her mother embodies, and she's trying to attain her mother as well. So in a way, the Middle East becomes synonymous for her with her mother.
Yeah.
So it becomes so much more weighted in her life. And so I think that those moments in the Middle East, I mean, there may be, I'm not sure like percentage wise how much of the book is set in the Middle East versus in the States, but like those moments are really, really weighted because of their unattainable aspect for her.
Right. And I think the moments with the mother are really weighted, even though she doesn't have, I don't want to say she doesn't have that much time on the page, but she's not in the narrative. very much, but when she's in there, she's just this larger than life character. And you really capture the toxic nature of the relationship between the mother and daughter, and the relationship between a person with borderline personality disorder and codependency, that dynamic between them. I was curious if you struggled to portray those characters and the truth of their relationship in a way that would resonate with readers who maybe don't know about these disorders. I'm thinking of the moment when the mom calls the daughter and she screams, "You bitch." And some readers might be like, well, that seems not, maybe not so real. But anyone who's anybody with borderline personality disorder would know that, oh, yes, it is. So I'm curious about, as you were writing it, what you were thinking about how readers might understand this toxic relationship.
I mean, that's really funny, because there were times when I would be, you know, I went to Iowa and I workshopped portions of this novel. And I workshopped that chapter. And I remember my classmates being like, no way, like that wouldn't happen. And I was just thinking like, yeah, with BPD, it would happen, right? And sometimes people couldn't quite understand why the narrator couldn't just see like, oh, this person is toxic, or oh, this person is like going to hurt you, or why can't you break free from these patterns? And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, I happen to understand codependency and borderline personality disorder and all of that psychology. And some people immediately, you know, just like, boom, they get that, no question. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I think the whole point of the novel is for somebody that doesn't necessarily understand that to understand that. And to
Right. And I think I think you do that.
Thank you. Yeah.
I just got a chill. Yeah, exactly.
Right. So it's like its own world. In addition to the cultural world and the sort of world of sexuality, there's also that world, the world of like codependency and what causes it, right? Like
how difficult it is to get out of those relationships.
Exactly.
And living with mental illness and having mental illness shape your identity as a child. That's intense, you know?
My goodness. Yeah. Even just talking about it now. Right. Exactly. Thinking about how mental illness shapes your identity as a child, and how do you go on as an adult? Like, how do you conduct your relationships as an adult when you grow up with somebody mentally ill?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, I think I was obsessed with the relationship between the mother and the narrator in this book, obviously, because that was actually one of the most important pieces of the book in terms of claiming or reclaiming an identity moving forward. So I'm always drawn in the push-pull in books where we see the ego, particularly, of a narcissistic mother try to subsume the identity of the child or take it over, and how the child either kind of falls in line with what the mother wants in order to receive this kind of acceptance, or feels estranged from their family because they can't be accepted as who they are, but they can't be any other way. Can you talk about your experience as a writer shaping that mother-daughter narrative a little bit? Did it go as you imagined it would when you began writing the book?
Well, it was the central challenge of writing the book was shaping the mother-daughter narrative. And I mean, it took me a while to really even arrive at what you're saying, is that like tension almost between wanting to please the mother, but also feeling, you know, I'm not sure if this is exactly what you're saying, but like just there's this tension for this narrator between wanting to please the mother, wanting to belong to the mother, but also like needing to break free from the mother and like be her own self and be true to herself and be authentic to herself. And so and also like another aspect of the mother-daughter relationship. So first I was trying to convey that struggle that the narrator embodies.
Yeah.
But then secondly, another thing was one of the trajectories of this book, in my opinion, is like the narrator going from a place of hurt and anger from the mother towards the mother to a place of like empathy and love and detachment at the same time, all of those things. And that meant that I had to choose moments in depicting this relationship that were both showed the mother as she is and in her relation and how she's treated her daughter and why her daughter behaves in the ways that she does, but also to show the mother in her own right. And, you know, the mother who is a immigrant, who grew up, you know, under occupation in the West Bank, who grew up between two major wars, who was brought to this country, America, by her husband, you know, without any desire really to be here, with a deeper connection to her home country of Palestine, and who has had her own set of like traumas and struggles. And I really tried to balance all of these things, is to show that when any scene with this mother is like showing her fury and also her vulnerability, showing the narrator wanting to belong to her and wanting her approval while also wanting to break free from her and to carve out her own identity and be true to that identity. So much of writing the relationship with the mother was also writing the relationships around the mother that shed light on the relationship with the mother.
Yeah, there were some really great moments when the mother's friends were around and when the protagonist would come and just how they interrelated with her. Something that makes this novel so compelling, I think, too, is that you present readers with situations they may be a little new to, like the one we were just talking about, the borderline personality disorder, codependent relationship. Also, the idea of sexuality with regards to how this narrator struggles with her queerness and also her internalized homophobia. Mm-hmm. How did you have that conflict manifest in your narrator, that struggle?
I mean, I think that that struggle, that internalized homophobia, is a lot of why she behaves in the ways that she does, where it's like, I mean, I was so interested in showing how destructive internalized homophobia can be, not only for the person that experiences it, but for the people that try and love that person. Mm-hmm. There are relationships in the novel that are healthy, you know, in the sense that the person does see the narrator and does want to be close to the narrator without wanting to hurt the narrator. And the narrator can't allow that because of this internalized loathing and homophobic just sort of system that derives from many, many sources. And that was hard for me to allow myself to write because it can be so ugly, internalized homophobia. But I really wanted to show the reality of it because I rarely have read, I guess I was just interested in reading something that really showed what that could look like.
Yeah, I haven't read a lot with that in it either.
Right. So,
no. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love that approach as having a bisexual character because it allows you to see that she's striving. It's almost like, I mean, I'm not saying that she is gay, striving back toward men to feel acceptance of herself and possibly reclaim this acceptance from her culture, because that doesn't explain bisexuality or why it occurs. But there is this small element of, if the mother accepts her when she's with a man, then maybe that makes being with the man just a little bit easier. Or something in that way that comes through in one of the passages in the book, at least for me.
And I think that's hard for her because, like, being bisexual, it seems like it's in her mother's eyes almost. It's like, you're doing this to hurt me because you could just as easily be with a man. And then the narrator doesn't know how to psychologically, part of the struggle is to psychologically detach from that way of thinking that her mother is like sort of projecting onto her, because that's certainly not what bisexuality is. Not really about. So I think that that aspect of it further complicates things for the narrator, her bisexuality, and complicates.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And is also just complicated for her mother to understand, almost more so than like if she was a lesbian.
Right.
Oh my goodness. Exactly. Because I almost think it's easier to just write straight or write gay. I mean, I hate to say that, but I do think for the sake of simplicity and the trajectory or the line of a narrative, it's almost easier to do that because it develops so many complexities when there's these other elements of the love interests and all of the social and cultural pieces that are coming into that. Was there ever a moment when you almost made the book go one way or the other? And I'm particularly interested in this segment, the piece of the book where there's this male faculty character who seems to me to also be a love addict. And I'm wondering, when you decided to shape or include that, it felt like a different book or a departure for a minute. But maybe that's because that kind of narrative triggers a lot of people who've had this experience with mentors or people in positions of power. So all of a sudden, you know, I went down a slightly different path and then I came back to the narrative. Can you speak to your process ideas about writing the lovers you chose to include?
I agree. I think that character is also a love addict. And I, first of all, I was really, one thing that was another challenge of writing this book was showing the messiness of in-betweenness and like being both and overlaps of that, the sort of contradictions of that, rather than just being one way or another, you know, in terms of sexuality, in terms of cultural background, in terms of anything, everything. So there's just so much sort of messy overlappingness within this picture and like the way that she behaves. And certainly choosing the love interests there was a sort of roadmap for me in terms of like, do they match a certain criteria? Because there has to be a pattern, in my opinion, for the people that she falls for. A lot of the people that she falls for are either either unattainable or unavailable, or there's a power dynamic of some sort. Often there's a power dynamic that mimics the sort of power dynamic that she has with her mother. And so I really thought about all of those factors in choosing and depicting the lovers, particularly the relationships that are more destructive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wanted to shift gears a little bit, and I wanted to ask if you would talk a little bit about your publishing journey, how you got from your finished draft to where you are today.
So I went to Iowa. I spent several years workshopping. I then left, moved to New York City, and worked on the book on my own, but also with a writer's group. And I had a partner at the time that was really, really a great reader and extremely supportive. And once I felt that it was, you know, after many drafts, I felt that it was ready to be shared, at least with an agent. I queried an agent that a friend had suggested I get in touch with, saying like, oh, I think you'll really get along. So I sent her a query and she asked to see the manuscript. She read it. Funny enough, like right before I sent it to her, I changed it entirely where I just made, it's not a straight through chronological narrative, but I turned it around and made it one. And I like put everything in chronological order for some reason. I took out all the like flashbacks and made them their own sort of sections that fit within time. And I sent it to her and she was like, I really love this. I feel like something is off. Let's meet and talk. We met and talked and she asked me, she was like, was there a different structure before this? And I said, oh my goodness, like just the fact
that 10 minutes before.
Exactly. Just the fact that she could sense that meant so much to me. And she really, what I loved about her also is that she wasn't interested in the, like, certainly the book, a lot of its strength derives from its cross-culturalness and the Middle Eastern aspect of the book, but she was reading it for the story and for the like sort of love stories and the mother-daughter story and like not through an exotic lens or that.
Right.
I had shared pages with other people in the industry before that had wanted more of the sort of exotic, wanted more spices from the marketplace, wanted more women in hijab.
Oh dear.
Wanted more of those like stereotypical, they wanted more camels, no joke. And oh, they just wanted those like stereotypical stock images. So I was really relieved that she didn't. And, you know, so then I changed it back to its original structure. I sent it back to her. She was on board. She loved it. And then we went out like a few months later. She gave me some notes, I incorporated them, and we went out a few months later and out on submission, and we sold it to exactly the right editor for me.
Oh, wow. It sounds perfect.
Yeah. An editor that I was hoping actually to work with, Jonathan Lee at Catapult, who just has such an amazing vision and was just also completely, I felt, got the novel and was also not reading it for the exotic aspect. And so I just really loved his edits as well once we sold it to him. And then we kind of went back and forth with the draft a couple of times and sort of deep into a few sections. And then, yeah, that was the process.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. Were there substantive edits from the time that it went from your agent to the editor, or did you feel that they were just kind of cleanup edits?
There were cleanup edits from the time it went from my agent to the editor. And then when it got like, yeah, it was very, I mean, really, we spent maybe like 1 month, like, or I spent like 3 weeks really even just doing edits between when we signed and when we sold it. And then when we sold it, there was a lot of like sort of deepening, just like hunkering down on certain sections and just like expanding them. And also really trying to convey what does love addiction look like really trying to communicate that for people that don't get that.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness, this has been so interesting. And we are super looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from You Exist Too Much. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's cocktail is called On the Ledge, and the name of the drink comes from a setting in the book. The recipe is on the blog if you want to make one and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. It's 1 ounce of vodka, 2 ounces of pomegranate juice, 1 ounce of lemon, some honey to taste, a splash of rose water, which I really love, and some soda water. And you fill a shaker with ice and you add everything but the soda water, and then you strain and then you top with soda water. I'm making mine now.
I probably made mine wrong because I just dumped some rose extract in.
It looked really pretty. You sent me a picture. It looked great.
Awesome. So Zaina, is there anything you'd like to tell us about the passage you'll be sharing today?
I am going to read from the opening pages of the novel, and then I'll read one more section that doesn't really need any setup. It's just parts of one of the love stories or from the novel. Yeah. And I'm reading from the opening pages of the novel. In Bethlehem, when I was 12, men in airy white gowns sat at a three-legged table outside the Church of the Nativity, They ran prayer beads through their fingers and sipped mint tea in gold-rimmed cups shaped like hourglasses, steam floating off the surface and up into the bright blue sky. I walked past them with my mother and my uncle as we wandered through the holy city. One of the men called out, "Haram, forbidden for the especially devout among us. It's haram to eat meat unless the animal has been killed in a specific way. Haram to drink alcohol. Haram for a pubescent girl to expose her legs in a biblical city." It occurred to me then that I wasn't a flat-chested kid anymore, that curves had begun to appear along the length of me. I was no longer indistinguishable from a boy child. "What should we do?" I asked my mother. I felt a pulsing lump take shape in my throat as I noticed her teeth gritting, her jaw extended and temples shimmering. My great-grandparents' house was where we were staying and where all of my clothes were, 36 miles and 3 checkpoints away. I felt myself glow cold, and I closed my eyes and prepared to receive her reaction. I knew better than to try and preempt it with an apology. All I could do was strategically try to calm myself, to remember that the anticipation was heavier than the thing itself. I should have had more sense than to dress in such a way when we were visiting the birthplace of a prophet, albeit not our own. My mother had, and still has, a native's knowledge. She knows the rules instinctively in that part of the world, and I only ever learn them by accident. "Basita," said my uncle. "It's okay." My mother looked me up and down. We approached the main door of the church, and the men hissed again. My uncle ran the tips of his fingers across his mustache, then looked to my mother and me. "Come," he said. "I have an idea." We followed him into a gift shop just off Mangere Square. He dropped a few coins on the counter, then asked the shopkeeper if we could use his bathroom. My mother grabbed a Kit Kat off the shelf and tore it open, breaking apart 2 sticks without a second thought. My uncle dropped 3 more shekels on the counter. The man pointed towards the back. "Shukran," my uncle said, and led the way. His master plan was that he would trade me his trousers for my Roxy surfer shorts. He went into the bathroom first, and I could hear sounds of fumbling, his belt jangling as it hit the floor. He opened the door slightly and handed his pants to my mother so she could administer the swap. She then stood in front of me while I took off my shorts. "Yalla," she said, her most frequently used word. "Hurry." I pulled on the pair of pants. They sagged on me. I had to tighten the belt buckle all the way up to the last hole and then roll the waist so they wouldn't fall off, leaving me completely exposed. I stepped out of the bathroom and looked at my uncle. I examined my new curves against his pasty legs, gangly and covered in sporadic patches of hair, my shorts tight against his thighs like boxer briefs. It occurred to me in that moment to question why, as a man, his bare legs were somehow less troubling than mine. It was a double standard, a shame I had simply accepted until then. In acquiring my gender, I had become offensive. But as I stood in front of him, an unexpected pride began to swell inside me. I liked the way his trousers made me feel, like I could get attention from boys, from girls. I felt, for once, seen. "Inti walad wala binat? Are you a boy or a girl?" A security guard at the Intercontinental Hotel in Amman had once asked my cousin Noor this question when deciding whether to lead her into the curtain-shrouded women's check for an intimate pat-down before she could enter the lobby. "Binet," Noor had responded. "Girl." She'd been insulted by the question, the uncertainty it revealed. But not me, not that day. Wearing my uncle's trousers, I enjoyed occupying blurred lines. Ambiguity was an unsettling, yet exhilarating space. As we walked back towards the Church of the Nativity, I looked at my mother and smiled, desperate for her to smile back. But she withheld. She offered only a freshly disconcerting look, scrunching up her forehead so that lines appeared, her cheekbones protruding, her mouth forming a terrifying expression of indifference. At the time, I couldn't quite place the source of it. Had she noticed my contentment? Did it scare her? Only now, years later, do I think I understand. It was in that moment that she first realized I wasn't like her. The trousers were a demarcation line, one that separated me from my mother and her lineage. I wonder sometimes if that was the day that this began, this habit of constant seeking, of endlessly striving to earn my way back, a pattern that would send me on a misguided quest for love. I communicated something to my mother as I stood there smiling in a pair of men's pants, a message I didn't know I was sending to her. She has always known first what I have yet to see, has always seen it before I could. "Look at me," I wanted to say to her then. "Please don't look away." The next section also doesn't really need much setup. It's just a beginnings of a love for this narrator. "Where do you live?" the professor wrote me. We'd met the previous summer, almost a year earlier. She taught French literature at the Alliance Française in Midtown East, in between semesters at Columbia. On the first day, she had announced that past students had told her she didn't smile enough. So she put her palms on the edge of the desk and leaned forward smiling, as if to say, "Here you go." I had loved her since the day she kept me after class and suggested I was too harsh on Emma Bovary for her childish fantasies. "Emma's pathetic, sure," she said, pressing a polished fingernail to the word méprisable on my paper. From the dinosaur band-aid on that same finger, I surmised a husband and kids. "But this is melodramatic." She looked at me, paused, then offered an effortful smile. For the first time, I noticed the dimple that appeared above her lip when she smiled, like a second smaller smile. While we stood there, I began to fall into its span. As I gathered up my things and walked towards the classroom door, she asked, "Is it so bad?" I stopped and turned towards her. "Is what so bad?" "To have an affair?" she asked. Her question seared. It felt both suggestive and forgiving. At the time, a photo of Elliot Spitzer and his scorned wife, Silda, adorned the front page of the New York Post. I felt myself blush. "I don't know," I said, "but it is in this country." She laughed. Her laugh was deep and started in the back of her throat, getting increasingly lighter as it worked its way forward. "True," she said. My body surged with heat. When I got home that night, I Googled her. I discovered that she wrote fiction. A short story with her byline came up, a simple piece about a woman struggling to keep her marriage intact as the other couples in their circle divorced. I wondered if it was based on truth, and I searched for details that matched her reality as I knew it. During class the following week, I made a point to mention it. "I read your story," I said, nervous to admit it and tingling with excitement, as though I had accessed some part of her that was now laid bare between us. "Oh," she said. She nodded once, then offered the smile. "Thank you." She appeared not to care whether I liked it, confident that it was good without my approval. Still, I felt encouraged to say, "It would be nice to meet up sometime, maybe after the class is over." She nodded in return. "It would." We met in early September at the Nespresso store in Midtown East, 3 blocks from our classroom. I showed up in a pencil skirt and a silk sleeveless shirt. The conversation flowed. She talked about walking her daughter to school, her husband's startup, their vacation home in Saint-Paul-de-Vence on the Côte d'Azur. I tried to match her level of privilege and exposure. "I've been to Nice once," I said. I didn't mention that I'd gone with Kate, my ex-girlfriend, towards the end of our relationship. I was worried that as a straight French woman, the entire concept of queerness would make her uncomfortable. We ordered cappuccinos, and I resisted asking for skim milk so as not to seem too weight conscious or too American. When the bill came, I hesitantly asked if she would send me some of her unpublished writing to read. She placed her credit card on the table as I reached for my wallet, waving my hand away. "You want to read more from me?" she asked, sounding almost suspicious. I panicked. Until then, I'd felt emboldened, but her response was humbling. "I thought I'd ask," I said, "if that's okay." "Sure," she said. She smiled again. It was starting to feel more natural any time she did so. "I'm just surprised, is all." We stepped outside the cafe, and as we walked off in different directions, I felt overwhelmed. I wanted her. I wanted her life. I wanted to live inside her life while still living inside my own. I wanted, above all, for her to like me. 2 days later, when she still hadn't sent any of her work, I followed up. 3 essays arrived in my inbox that night. She seemed to be a guarded person, so reading her unpublished writing was like cutting to the front of a long line. The problem was asymmetry. Not only was she straight, but she had a husband to share her inner world with. I presumably had Anna's world, my girlfriend at the time, yet somehow hers was never nearly as captivating. "I read each of the essays several times. They're nice," I wrote in response, still afraid to shatter a veneer of detachment. A month later, we went to lunch, but I couldn't eat. I wore a dress that once belonged to my mother, her gold hoop earrings, her Michelle watch. Anything beautiful that's mine was once hers. Now that I'd read the professor's writing, now that her sapphire wedding ring was refracting light from every surface, I was too conscious of my motions to land the fork in my mouth, so I stopped trying. "Sorry," I said, laughing dumbly. "I can't eat and talk at the same time." She had chosen a place on the Upper West Side known for its burgers, but I ordered a salad. I imagined she was judging me in that moment. I'm familiar with that judgment. But how could I eat something so unsexy as a cheeseburger in front of the sexiest woman in the universe, She continued to look attractive and in control as she ate her burger, chewing with unapologetic authority. I had the ridiculous salad packed up, though I knew I'd never eat it. When the check came, I offered to pay. I had looked up the place beforehand, cash only, and I fumbled self-consciously through bills fresh from the ATM. My eyes began to blur. I put down too much for the tip. We got up and left, and the minute she turned the corner from the restaurant, tears spilled down my cheeks. I was certain that I'd given myself away by not eating, though I admit, by then, a part of me wanted her to suspect. Thank you.
Wow. It was so nice to hear those two different excerpts. This was such a pleasure to hear you read from this book today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Rand might have another question before we're able to.
I do. We're about to wrap up, and I'm just curious what advice you would offer to new writers.
Find a community, I would say, because writing can be kind of alienating at times. And I think having a community, whether it be, you know, through a writing workshop, through just a writing group that you create, that you sort of find within, you know, your friend group, just having other people that know what it's like to write around you, really, really helpful. And another piece of advice I would give is to persist and to know that there is a lot of, like, I don't know, feelings of just being sort of discouraged. And at times, you know, there's rejection when it comes to writing. But I think that it's important to know that's part of the process, those feelings and, you know, those realities, and to just keep going.
That's great advice. Really good. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm curious about, I'm going to be nosy. And like your character wanted to know information about unpublished work from the woman she had the crush on, I would like you to tell us a little bit more about your next projected projects. What are you going to be working on for the next year? And also maybe tell us whose books you might be reading to prepare for your next journey in your writing.
Well, I get really superstitious for some reason when I talk about future writing. So I'm writing a novel right now that is set between Europe and the Middle East. And instead of a writer as a protagonist, an artist in a different form. More of a sort of mystery rather than like a psychological exploration. And then I'm also working on this essay collection that explores Arab and Muslim characters in the diaspora who are also on the outskirts in various ways, or feel themselves outsiders in various ways, sexuality-wise, culturally, religiously, what have you. Yeah, and I'm reading a lot of Edward Said, who's like a prominent thinker. I've been reading a lot of sort of contemporary novels that have been coming out lately. I'm just reading Lauren Euler's novel right now, Fake Accounts. I'm reading Kink, which is an anthology of sex and erotica writing that was edited by R.O. Kwan and Garth Greenwell. So lots on my nightstand.
Excellent. Well, we can't wait to read what you write next.
Thank you.
We want to really thank you for spending time with us today at Book Tales. We enjoy talking to you so much and hearing you read from your work.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. It was wonderful. I really appreciated your questions and your very thoughtful reading.
That's what we're here for. Okay. So everybody, please order Zaina's book, You Exist Too Much. It's great. And be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the book tales, readings, and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversations with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.